We hear the word of the Lord as we read together today. Matthew 16, verse 1. The Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He replied, "When evening comes, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah." Jesus then left them and went away. When they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. "Be careful," Jesus said to them. "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." They discussed this among themselves and said, "Well, it's because we didn't bring any bread." Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, "You of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? How is it you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? But be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees." Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever who loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Amen. We thank God for this reading from his word, and we'll hand over to Matthew.
I love it when you're maybe exploring a different country, or even if you're exploring this country, and you find some ancient ruins, you find some old ruins. In fact, it blows my mind that even in England, there are some Roman ruins. That's how far the Romans got. That's how big their empire was. And I love it. I love the fact that when you look at these ruins, you see a little bit of the Roman Empire. You see a little bit of their kingdom, of what it looked like. See, when the Romans conquered somewhere, they started to build Roman things. They made it look Roman. In other words, they didn't just defeat and conquer other kingdoms. they then expanded and built their own kingdom. They didn't just conquer other kingdoms, they built their own kingdom. Well, in a sentence, Matthew chapter 16 is all about King Jesus conquering a kingdom and then building his own kingdom. Specifically, King Jesus is conquering the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of Satan and death and darkness, and he is building his own kingdom. King Jesus is conquering the kingdom of darkness and building his own kingdom. So 3 points quickly as we think about this. Firstly, in Matthew 16, there is a kingdom of darkness. There is the kingdom of darkness. And look at verse 1. After being in Gentile territory, Jesus steps back onto Jewish soil, and he's met by another crowd in verse 1. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees came, and to test him, they asked him to show him a sign from heaven. Jesus answered them, "When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times." It baffles me that the Pharisees would ask for a sign. I mean, where have they been? Jesus has been performing miracles constantly through the Gospels. But the problem is not lack of evidence. It's just lack of sight. There's plenty of signs to see already. They just can't see them. Or it's maybe better to say they see the signs with their eyes, but they cannot see how these signs prove who Jesus is. They can understand how to read the weather, Jesus says, but they can't read spiritual things. Natural things they can see, supernatural things they can't. Spiritually, they are in total darkness. And yet they cannot see because they will not see. They don't want to see. Their very hearts are turned against Christ, and they're committed to other things other than him. One writer called Peter Lighthart, who I found helpful in this passage, he says that they have a heart problem that leads to an eye problem and an ear problem. They will not see and they will not hear because they don't want to. Their eyes are darkened because their hearts are dead. How do we know that it's a heart problem? Well, look at verse 4. Jesus tells them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign." In other words, they aren't just misguided, they're trying to see and they can't. Jesus says their very hearts are evil and adulterous. In other words, their hearts are unfaithful. The very leaders of Israel, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, have turned to other lovers, so to speak. They've turned to other gods. They've chased other things. This is idolatry. It doesn't necessarily mean bowing down to a stone structure, but bowing down to a whole host of things in your heart. It means committing yourself to, loving and serving wholeheartedly, a replacement for God. Calvin said that the human heart is an idol factory. The human heart naturally just produces idols for itself to worship. And so it cannot naturally see the true God. It cannot hear him or see him because it will not, because it is preoccupied with other things. It is committed to other gods. And what about the disciples? Well, look at verse 6. And naturally speaking, the disciples are not much better. Jesus warns them in verse 6, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." In other words, watch out for their teaching, don't follow in their ways. And when the disciples can't see what Jesus means, Jesus says, "Do you not perceive? Do you not remember what you've seen? How is it that you fail to understand?" Basically, can you not see? In other words, from top to bottom, from the Pharisees to the fishermen, Israel is in darkness. They are oppressed by the kingdom of darkness. And so Jesus says that no sign will be given them apart from one. Look at verse 4 again. "A An evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given except the sign of Jonah. The sounds quite cryptic from Jesus, but think for a moment about Jonah. Jonah was a prophet, and a prophet who almost sort of dies and rises again 3 days later. Some scholars think he really did die, but at least he had a dramatic near-death experience. He's thrown overboard a ship, he sinks into the darkness, and 3 days later, he's raised up again. So Jesus' death and resurrection proves himself as the true prophet, the true Jonah. But what else happened with Jonah? Think again of the story. Jonah was not just a prophet, he was a prophet in Israel, as Israel was starting to worship false gods. He was a prophet at a time of darkness, just like Jesus. Not only that, but following Jonah's death and resurrection experience, what happens? The gospel, the word of God, starts to travel somewhere else, doesn't it? It starts to go to the enemies of Israel, the Ninevites, the Gentiles. I'm sure you've been there before where you don't really know how great something is until you lose it, until you don't have it anymore. If you can imagine, you don't know how maybe precious and valuable a piece of jewelry is until it gets lost. And even worse, until maybe you see someone else wearing something like it and enjoying it, and maybe you feel slightly jealous. It's a bit of a silly illustration, but in Jonah's day, God wasn't rejecting his people. There was always a faithful remnant in Israel. But I think there is a sense where salvation is being enjoyed by the Ninevites to sort of provoke Israel to jealousy. They hear of the Lord's mercy and kindness to Nineveh, the worst enemies, and so they might just come back to God themselves. So what's going on? Well, Jesus is fulfilling the sign of Jonah, and the Pharisees will soon see it. Jesus will die and will rise 3 days later, and the gospel will spread through Israel and even to the enemies, the Ninevites, the Gentiles, all the nations, even us here this morning. This is how King Jesus will conquer the kingdom of darkness around the whole world, every nation and people and language, and perhaps even Israel will see and come back into this light as well. This is the sign of Jonah, and it's how Jesus conquers the kingdom of darkness. So this is our second point, the king who conquers and builds. King Jesus not only conquers this kingdom of darkness, but he builds his own kingdom. And look at verse 13. And verse 13, Jesus brings his disciples to a place called Caesarea Philippi. Why does he do that? Why do they go to Caesarea Philippi? Well, let me read you a section from the biggest story Bible, which the children are listening to next door. Listen to what it says about Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi was a big name because it was named after some important people, the Roman Emperor, Caesar, and the Jewish ruler of the region, Herod Philip, so it's called Caesarea Philippi. It had not one, but two temples. One was the temple of Augustus, built to honor the Roman Emperor. The other was a temple to a Greek god, Pan. Then listen to this, this is what it says. Caesarea Philippi was this big place, a place filled with worship of the wrong rulers and dead idols. And in this big place, Jesus asked his disciples a big question. Who is Jesus? Jesus takes his disciples to the kingdom of darkness, to the very pinnacle of the kingdom of darkness, so to speak, in Caesarea Philippi, and he asks them, who do you think that I am? That might seem like a strange question, but it's actually very relevant. Because Jesus is going to build a kingdom full of people who believe and worship him as the only true God, He's going to build a kingdom not of people who worship the emperor like the Romans, or Pan like the Greeks, or even the idols of their own hearts like the Pharisees and the disciples, and indeed all of humanity. No, Jesus will build a kingdom of people who will confess and worship him as the only living God. So the question is extremely relevant to the disciples. Who do you say that I am? First, Jesus asked, verse 13, who do people say that I am? And the disciples give a range of answers. Prophets like John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah. Maybe these names were floating around because there were prophets like Jesus. Sometimes there was superstition built around them. But they're all the wrong answers. And so Jesus asks his disciples, in a world of darkness, he asks them, verse 15, who do you say that I am? It's very pointed. Who do you say that I am? I wonder what you would say to that. We asked just the boys and girls a minute ago. It's all very well saying, well, some people think this, some people think that, but what about you? Throughout the Gospels, the crowd is all sort of painted negatively. They sort of hang around Jesus. They're often interested, sometimes even amazed, and yet they never quite nail their colors to the mast. Have you? Are you sort of just in the crowd, sort of associated with Jesus? Or do you really believe that it's true? Do you really believe that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Well, Jesus asks this question to his disciples, and it's Peter who speaks up. Look at verse 15. Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. So we said at the beginning that Matthew 16 is all about Jesus conquering the kingdom of darkness and building a new one. Well, how exactly does he do it? How is it even possible for people living in darkness to see the light of the gospel? How is it possible as a worshiper of dead gods to confess Jesus, the Son of the living God? The only way is for the Father in heaven to supernaturally reveal it to you. As a Christian, this is your story. You were once dead. And it was at root a heart problem. Your heart was dead, and so your eyes were blind and your ears were deaf. But the Father, by his Spirit, revived your heart and opened your eyes. He made you see. He has led you from the darkness into the kingdom of light. The very faith by which you cling on to Christ is a gift. Isn't that amazing? That which flesh and blood could not reveal to you, that which flesh and blood could not understand, nor perceive, nor receive, that which was once utter foolishness to you, is now your precious treasure and your highest joy. What changed? The Lord revealed it to you. He brought you out of darkness and into light. Jesus conquers. And not only that, he plunders the kingdom of darkness. He calls his people, he rescues us out of it, and he builds us into a new kingdom, verse 18, that the gates of hell shall not prevail against. Now, I know next to nothing about how to build a house. I don't know what goes into building a house, but I always admire other people who are able to build these amazing structures. Well, when Jesus is talking about his kingdom or his church in these verses, he introduces two images sort of based around a house. He talks about the rock and the keys, or the foundation and the keys. Just before we move on, let's think about these for 2 minutes really quickly. The rock means the foundation of the church, and the keys has to do with ruling or guiding the church. Sort of, if you imagine, locking up or binding that which is not allowed, and then loosing that which is allowed, the rock and the keys. And Jesus says to Peter, you're the rock, and to you has been given the keys. Look at verse 18 in your Bibles. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Do you hear what he's saying? On this rock I'll build my kingdom, and the kingdom of darkness will not prevail against it. Then he says, verse 19, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, some people disagree over what these words mean exactly. Some people think that Peter's confession specifically is the rock on which Christ builds the church. And a lot of people think this, and it could be true, but I'm not totally convinced it is true. After all, Jesus names Peter, Peter, meaning rock, Petra in Greek. Peter, in some way, is the rock on which Christ builds the church. But on the other extreme, some people say Peter alone is the rock, and Peter alone has the keys. But that's not true either. The Bible doesn't say anything about Peter being more special than the other apostles, and it certainly doesn't say anything about Peter's successors being more special or being anyway elevated above the other apostles. So what does it mean? Well, Ephesians 2 verse 20 says, the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone. In other words, all the apostles and the prophets are the rock on which the church is built. Likewise, in Matthew 18, it's all the apostles that are given the keys of the kingdom. So it's the words of the apostles that the church is built on. It's the words of the apostles that the church is governed by and ruled by. These men speak on behalf of Christ, and it's on these words that Christ builds and governs his church. Christ is conquering the kingdom of darkness. He's opening blind eyes by his Spirit. He's plundering Satan's kingdom. And he's building a kingdom built on his words, trusting in his words, rooted and grounded in his words, and governed by his words forever. And he says, the gates of hell, the kingdom of darkness, shall not stand against it. There is a kingdom of darkness, but the king conquers and builds his own kingdom. More briefly, the king conquers and builds. The king also suffers and dies. The king suffers and dies. You're maybe wondering why this quite inspiring passage ends almost in an anticlimax in verse 20. Look at verse 20. After all of this amazing passage, verse 20, then Jesus strictly charged his disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Seems really strange, doesn't it? It seems like the whole point is to go and advance this message that Jesus is the Christ. Why does this have to be a secret? Well, it's because of what happens next in the passage. Look at verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem. Do you see how he's still opening their eyes? He's still showing them, healing their blindness. He begins to show them that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me. For you're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of men. Perhaps Jesus' messiahship should be a secret for now, since the disciples don't quite know what it means. Whenever I was in school, I sort of gradually noticed the board at the front getting harder and harder to read. And my teacher was very accommodating for me. She kept bringing me a row in front and then a row in front. And then when I was nearly at the front row, I started to think, maybe I should check my eyes and see if they're okay. And the rest is history, and obviously I wear glasses now from then on. But without my glasses, I can see, but I also can't quite see. I'm not in total darkness, but I certainly can't see clearly. Everything's blurry. And it's the same with Peter spiritually. Jesus is healing their blindness. He's giving them sight, but he's doing it gradually. He's doing it slowly. And so Peter sees, but he doesn't quite see. I mean, what a turnaround for Peter. At first, Jesus rejoices that Peter recognizes him. But can Peter see what Jesus has come to do? Well, not really. Peter can see that Jesus is the King. He's the Son of the living God. But can he see what kind of King Jesus is? Not really. In Jewish thought, the Messiah would come to free God's people from their enemies. And this is true. But it's actually short-sighted. They thought that the Christ would free them from the Romans, from their political enemies. But Jesus has come to free them from enemies far worse than even the Romans. Peter likely thought the Messiah would conquer with bloodshed and violence. But Jesus says that's the things of men, not the things of God. Peter thinks the death of the Messiah would be a disaster, a failure. But that's the things of men, not the things of God. Did you notice that word in verse 21? From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things. The king will conquer with violence and bloodshed, but with violence inflicted upon himself, with bloodshed suffered by himself. And he says he must do it if he were to build this kingdom. A little bit like a beautiful threaded tapestry. Genesis chapter 3 is almost like a golden thread running through the whole Bible. It's the first promise of the gospel. It's when Jesus says to Satan, he's addressing Satan, and he says this, listen to this. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between her offspring and your offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. It's almost paradoxical, isn't it? The only way for Christ to crush the head of Satan is to be first bruised by Satan. The only way for Christ to demolish the kingdom of darkness is, like Jonah, to plummet into the darkness, to hang on a cross during hours and hours of darkness, crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? As he carries our sin into the darkness and buries it there. As he carries your sin on his shoulders. And because he did that for you, your sin has no claim on you. The threat of hell, the accusations of the devil, the lies of the darkness cannot touch you. Who is to condemn you? For Christ has died and has risen and is interceding for you. So do you see how the kingdom of darkness is demolished? Jesus comes valiantly, victoriously, mightily. He comes to conquer, but he conquers through suffering. And in dying, he plummets the kingdom of darkness. He plunders the kingdom of darkness, and he builds his church. Just as we close, we don't have time to look at verses 24 to 28. But just as an aside, it's always interesting, isn't it, reading these accounts. When we know what's coming up ahead, but Peter in Matthew 16 doesn't quite know what's coming ahead. He doesn't quite know yet what the future holds for Jesus, and he doesn't know yet what the future holds for himself either. Jesus just told him that he must go to the cross, it must happen. But even more than that, Jesus told him, Peter, if you're going to come after me, then you must take your cross and you too must suffer. You must take up your cross and follow me. This is really Christian discipleship, isn't it? It's following Christ, no matter the cost, knowing what it cost him. Peter doesn't yet know it, that the way of the master will be the way of the disciple. The way of the cornerstone will be the way of the foundation stones. As the disciples confess Christ, even unto death, and yet they do it because they know that, almost paradoxically, it's the ways of God, not the ways of man, that the true meaning of life is living for this King. As Jesus says, giving up your life is actually how you find it. Hold on to it and you lose it, but giving it in service to the King who first gave his life for you, who bought you out of the darkness, loving the one who first loved you, serving the King even unto death, who first served you unto death. Well, that is not only discipleship, it's not only the way of the disciple, but it's life to the full. Love so amazing, so divine, demands no less than your life, your soul, and your all.